I have thought about ending it all on many occasions. I have always worried about how that impacted on our three children. It has destroyed our lives. And although it was never my fault, I have always felt ashamed that they had to go through all of this. Those are the heartbreaking words of Oyeteyu Adedayo, one of the 59 sub-postmasters recently cleared of false accounting fraud or theft in what is widely described as this country's largest miscarriage of justice. £58 million has already been awarded in interim compensation, and the government has agreed to fund it. Recent work by The Guardian suggests a staggering £233 million has been set aside to pay restitution. Hundreds more cases like Oyeteyu's are awaiting review. Welcome to The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. To untangle this truly astonishing tale, I am lucky enough to be joined by Dr. Hannah Quirk, reader in criminal law at King's College London, with a particular focus on claims of wrongful conviction. Dr. Quirk is on the editorial board of the Criminal Law Review and a trustee of Transform Justice. Welcome to the podcast, Hannah.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Hannah, give us the short summary, the sort of noisy pub version of what has happened, and we will then dive into individual aspects, if that's okay.
Okay. This is what the Prime Minister's called one of the biggest miscarriages of justice in our history. And it's one of those really shocking cases that I think does cut across so that the public are aware of it. The Post Office installed a new software system across its whole network of post offices. And this started to show up discrepancies in the amount that the sub-postmasters and mistresses had in their tills and the amount that the computer software said that should be there. Now, these were people of really good character. If you think very often in small places, the person who runs the post office is a very trusted figure and known to everybody. They're a really key figure in their communities. And these people were telling the post office that the system's not working. Many of them were phoning the helpline saying, there's something wrong here. It's showing money's gone missing, which we can't account for. And the post office told them, no, you're the only person that's having problems with this. If there's a shortfall in the money, you've got to make up the shortfall. So people were borrowing money, they were remortgaging properties, and eventually they were prosecuted by the post office itself, because the post office has got the powers to prosecute people. And many of them pleaded guilty because they were told if you pleaded guilty to a less serious offence, then you can avoid going to prison. And you can imagine the terror these people felt that they might end up in prison for a crime they hadn't committed. And they've spent years and years trying to clear their name. And the post office knew, they clearly knew that there were flaws in the system, that it couldn't be relied on. And they hid that evidence from the people that they knew had been wrongly convicted and covered this up and obstructed it for years and years. And eventually, over the last couple of years, these people have gone to the Court of Appeal and have had their names cleared and their convictions quashed.
Yes, a small group of them has. How many sub-postmasters do we think were involved and over what sort of period? I know that the post office has written to 540 people, so we can take that as the low estimate, right? But I have heard numbers up to 800.
They prosecuted, I think, 736 staff between 1999 and 2015. So that's like one prosecution a week. And again, it seems odd that it didn't seem to occur to anybody that suddenly all these corrupt sub-postmasters and mistresses were coming to light, where previously there hadn't been such a problem. So it's a huge number of individuals. And of course, if you think many of them lived there with their families, they were often family businesses, that the knock-on effects, we've got the individual victims who were wrongly convicted, but then their families and the damage that was done to the wider communities as well.
That aspect of the case, I found, as someone with a sort of long ago legal background, I found that very difficult. I mean, the post office presumably will have a legal department. So it's not like this stuff was going through a big variety of sources. I mean, they told these people their cases were unique. Is it tenable to think that the post office genuinely thought there was a sudden fraud epidemic that just coincided with them moving on to this system? I find this really very hard.
It seems extraordinary. And they were presented with evidence repeatedly that there were problems within the system. Fujitsu told them that there were, you know, whistleblowers were saying there are issues with this system. I think they were telling the sub-postmasters that nobody else has access to the system, and it was relatively easy to establish that that wasn't the case, that it was possible for other people to access the system. There were bugs and there were glitches. As you said, I mean, it stretches credulity to think nobody thought it was an odd coincidence. They commissioned an independent report, which they shut down, I think, the day before it was due to report. They've resisted investigations by members of parliament, by journalists who've done some really good work on this, and the civil action. They tried every trick possible to resist the litigation there and were criticised in very strong terms by the judge for that.
Hannah, why is the post office, to an extent, still resisting? I mean, it's been seeking to appeal bits and bobs and aspects of various cases and sort of resisting the quashing of, you know, several. What's going on there? Why are they still entrenched when it's so obvious to everyone else this has been just a massive cock-up?
I think it's more than a cock-up, actually. I think there was it would seem that there were people who knew what was going on and didn't act. It wasn't necessarily just a mistake. There were decisions taken that they didn't want to disclose information. And again, if you are the investigating party, so in a normal prosecution, the police investigator case, they would look at the material. They've got powers the ordinary citizen hasn't got, and they have an obligation to share that with the other side. So if they find something that is helpful to the defendant, they're supposed to hand that over. And this wasn't done by the post office, who was acting in this case as the victim, as the investigator, and as the prosecutor.
Which seems extraordinary in its own right to have that power.
Utterly extraordinary, yes. Yes, and quite wrong. And again, normally you have somebody to check what's going on, because it's very easy to get into that mindset. If you are convinced that these people have done wrong, everything starts to look incriminating for them. That's why you need somebody else to challenge things and say, well, are you sure about that? What was going on in the organisation at the time? Obviously, parts of the post office were being sold off, so there's suggestions that they didn't want the reputational damage. The individuals involved have been well remunerated, are significant figures in various companies, have received honours from the Queen. If they start to admit wrongdoing, then there's a whole chain of things that may follow.
It's interesting, researching the case, I couldn't help but draw comparisons to how the BBC is being treated over what is an individual doing something wrong sort of 25 years ago versus of how little political attention this has had.
And also the Daniel Morgan case, which I know you've covered as well, that sense of an organisation wanting to protect itself if there's, you know, that something has gone wrong.
Yes, the corruption of sort of wanting to protect your reputation at all costs and willing to go to lengths and crush people in order to do that. And what I understand is that even though the post office in December 2019 paid 58 million in compensation to wrongly accused people, the language of the recent case being so strident opens the door for even more claims because it basically says that the post office acted in bad faith. Is that true?
I would think so. I'm not an expert in civil litigation. I think what's really difficult is that those who already received a settlement, it came out as a fairly derisory amount for each person once their legal fees had been paid. And I think the post office is suggesting now that they've had their compensation, so they can't be added into any new fund, which seems deeply unfair, as these are the people who have, you know, reached out to other postmasters. They formed an organisation, a support group for them. And, you know, if you think these are individuals who've had no contact with the criminal justice system before necessarily, who are thrown into this really, really difficult situation, and particularly for the civil cases, couldn't get legal aid. So many of them were having to defend themselves. Some ended up declaring themselves bankrupt because they lost so much. Unfortunately, in this country, we have the most appalling scheme for people who've been wrongly convicted. It's almost impossible to get compensation if you've been wrongly convicted of a crime. You have to be able to prove that you didn't commit the crime.
proving a negative is not easy, is it?
Almost impossible in any case. So my understanding is they wouldn't be eligible for the statutory compensation scheme for miscarriages of justice. Again, this all takes a long time, and this has been going on for some people for over 20 years now. Some of them have died. Very tragically, one killed themselves. So yes. The longer this drags on for, then, okay, they'll get a settlement eventually. But I think there really is a need to expedite these proceedings.
What about political responsibility? I actually remember Peter Lilly waving the card he said would replace the benefits book at a Tory conference in the mid-90s, which is what started this whole sort of need for a computer system. Several governments have been and gone. Why did none of them listen?
I imagine it was quite a long way down their list of priorities. It's one of these things as well that I suppose looks obvious with hindsight. You need to be taking quite a close look at these things. If ministers are being told everything's fine, that we've just suddenly got this wave of corrupt postmasters, that, you know, we're taking action against this now, we're cracking down, this is the benefit of the computer system, is we can uncover all this wrongdoing. You can see how a very positive spin could be put on that. I think it was particularly cruel how the post office isolated these individual people, telling them that they were the only person having these problems, they were the only person to be having the shortfall. But yes, undoubtedly, questions do have to be asked, and it's one of the difficulties, I suppose, with such a fragmented system and these partly privatised bodies. When you had a postmaster general who had a seat at the cabinet table, there was a fairly clear line of accountability.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I have seen a school of thought that this is symptomatic of this fragmentation, and specifically of a sort of culture of government outsourcing everything IT without retaining any internal know-how that can act as a check on whether an organization is getting what it paid for, whether it's working as intended. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, and particularly there was a change in the law a few years ago. Previously, if you were prosecuting on the basis of computer evidence, you had to show that it was reliable. And then the onus was changed to say that it was assumed computer information would be reliable unless you could show otherwise. So there's clearly, I think, a need perhaps to be more sceptical about some of this. Mm. Now, this is a huge IT project, clearly, if you think about how many sub-post offices there are across the country. And you're quite right, this needs very current expertise to be able to ask the right questions and to interrogate what IT specialists are telling you. So there are problems within the civil service having to undertake those roles. And also if auditors are brought in from a very limited range of companies, again, perhaps that there's not sufficient scrutiny of that. But I think it's very, very important that accountability has to be drawn in some ways. And as I said, you know, it was very easy, relatively easy in a nationalised model to do this. This is clearly a problem that cuts across all sorts of areas. So within the health service or within education, are we actually getting the IT infrastructure that we need? And is it secure? I mean, not just from bugs and gremlins that are wrongly convicting people, but is somebody else manipulating evidence that we're taking as sort of gospel truth?
Yes, the ransomware attack a couple of years back on the NHS system, I think, was an eye-opener for many people. It was genuinely difficult in preparing for this to hear the testimony of those affected. You know, from the man who had spent his 60th birthday in jail to the pregnant woman incarcerated for months having to give birth while wearing an electronic ankle tag and worrying what the midwife might think of her. You know, the surviving spouses of people who died without being exonerated. And as you said, there's even a documented case of someone taking their own life. And all the while, I got the sense that the misery has been magnified by being so stretched over time. Why has the process been so slow? I mean, once you do the test case that says, yes, this system was, you know, making mistakes and the post office was trying to cover them up, Why must each individual case then go through the same lengthy rigmarole?
It's a really good question. You're right, it's heartbreaking to hear some of those stories. And I think that's one of the really powerful aspects of this story, is that it could have been any of us. I think very often when people do hear about wrongful convictions, it's seen as, oh, well, they must have done something. If they didn't commit that crime, they did something else. But I think these kind of cases cut through, that people can understand any of us could be victim of a miscarriage of justice. And it's why it's so important that there are safeguards in place to try and stop this happening.
Was there any racial or class element? Because I have to say, watching a parade of people who are being exonerated to prepare for this podcast, just the absence of white middle class people was pretty notable.
I think that's something that should be looked at in many areas of the criminal justice system. Black and Asian people are overrepresented. And as you said, a lot of the sub-postmasters and mistresses were, I think, many of Indian origin. I think that is that's something that would be important to look at. Was there a bias in which cases were prosecuted? It may come down to something like those who didn't have the resources to fill the gaps in the till.
Yeah, that, maybe it's socioeconomic.
Yes, if people had the money, or they could borrow money and then make up the shortfall, then prosecutions didn't follow.
What struck me is the number of people who went into debt to pay back money they had never taken in the first place and pleaded guilty to avoid a tougher sentence. Is there something we can learn from this? Is there something fundamentally rotten in a system of plea bargaining that shoehorns innocent people into guilty pleas?
Yes. It's a much bigger problem in the States, where prosecutors can more blatantly negotiate. In this country, it's less overt, but it's particularly a problem where you'll cross the threshold for a custodial offence. So if you imagine how these people were feeling, the thing they were most frightened of was ending up in prison. So if they were told, if you plead guilty to a lesser offence, and it's such an awful choice.
And often they went to prison anyway.
Indeed, yes, which is particularly grotesque.
Yeah, I've seen example of people who basically went into debt to pay the money back, pleaded guilty and went to prison for months anyway. Yeah.
To have that dilemma, to know that you haven't done something wrong, but to have to say you have, just to, because pragmatically that will stop your children being taken into care or your parents losing their home, it's just awful. Unimaginably awful.
Why has this not been a bigger story? I know it's been a big story, but it feels like it should be a much bigger story. Is it just that Brexit and COVID-19 are swallowing all before them, like the news equivalent of Pac-Man? Or is it just not sexy enough for tabloids? Or is there maybe a worry that the general public will miss the diachronic element of the story and just blame the current government? I don't understand why this isn't sort of front page news for days on end.
Yes. I mean, relatively speaking, it's had far more coverage than any other miscarriage of justice in a long, long time. I mean, for years when I was teaching my students, I'd talk about the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four because they were the cases that cut through. And then eventually I realised that none of my students knew what I was talking about because they'd all been born after they were released by the Court of Appeal. Making a murderer in the United States has really kind of grabbed public awareness.
Yeah.
But as these cases go, this has had quite a lot of coverage. I suppose it's quite technical. You know, it's the inner workings of an IT system, which is perhaps less exciting than massive police corruption or somebody falsely confessing. Yes. And also,
or someone having an affair.
Well, indeed, yes. we do seem to have an ability to miss what the really important story is. What I hope is that the coverage this case has got, and I think that the human interest side of it is so important, but that we can use that to raise public awareness about some of the really serious things that are wrong with the criminal justice system at the moment.
Yes, and I'd like to finish on this. So, have we learned any lessons already? So is it changing things already? What lessons should we learn that we haven't yet? I mean, what reform should this lead to? I will take it as read that we need to separate those functions of the post office as victim, prosecutor, and sort of executioner. But what else do you think this could lead to that we'll see some positive come of this calamity?
Oh, you've taken it as read. I don't think the government has. They've ignored the recommendations of the Justice Committee that private prosecutions should be much more strictly regulated, unfortunately. I think it shows the importance of media, because a lot of this work was done by journalists sticking with this story. You know, Private Eye and Nick Wallace did an excellent podcast on this. I think the key thing is the importance of lawyers and of legal aid. So if you are charged with an offence, so if you run somebody over in your car and you're charged with death by dangerous driving, if you're a teacher or a nurse and a former patient or pupil makes an allegation of sexual abuse against you from 25 years ago, you may have to sell your house or use all your savings in order to defend yourself. And even if you are acquitted, you won't get your full costs back. If somebody is suing you, so civil legal aid is almost non-existent. So again, many of these postmasters found themselves having to represent themselves against very skilled post office lawyers. I think it also shows the importance of the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which, as I said, was set up in 1997, after the Birmingham Six case, to investigate miscarriages of justice. It's had a lot of criticism recently, and the government reviews it every so often to see if we still need it or not. I think this case in particular shows people why it's so important.
Yeah, and that it needs more staff. Not only do we need it.
It needs a lot more staff and money, yes. And you know that those cuts in funding have been a problem throughout, particularly, you know, we've had cuts of over a third in police budgets and prosecution budgets. Legal aid hasn't had a rise in something like 25 years. So you're asking fewer people to do more and more work, and they will cut corners, understandably. And the non-disclosure of important information in this case was deliberate. But sometimes it will just have been people didn't have time to look at things properly. So that's why we need more funding. And this isn't about letting criminals off or abusing the human rights system. Any of us could be the victim of crime or the victim of a miscarriage of justice. And these protections are so, so important. Because as you said, guilty people can be acquitted if the system is corrupted. And as so tragically happened in this case, innocent people were wrongly convicted.
In their hundreds. Dr. Hannah Quirk, thank you for helping me explore this difficult subject with such care. Listeners, remember there's a new Bunker Daily on Wednesday, Thursday and Saturday mornings. Your Start the Week supplement on Mondays and longer weekly full panel episode every Tuesday. So don't forget to subscribe, review and rate us. You can also support us on the funding platform Patreon. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. The last few months have been a period in which we have signed away vast aspects of our personal liberty and civil rights because a pandemic has demanded it, in which a government with scant regard for the rule of law, but a large majority, has given itself exceptional powers to impinge on our lives without minimal scrutiny or accountability. And the dummy in which millions of us suckle for comfort is the notion that only people who have done something wrong need to worry about the power of the state to crush citizens. As hundreds found out, that is a fairy tale we tell ourselves so we can function without being terrified. This is Alex Andreu in the Bunker saying over and out.
Bunker Daily was presented by Alex Andreu. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Yelena Sofronievich. An audio production was by me, Alex Reese. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.